Star Hit Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC and Cromwell Savings Bank, an equal housing lender, located at Main and West Streets in Cromwell. Here is your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and with me once again is Ed Corcoran, our radio historian, with our delightful guest for the night.
Well, he's one of the shyest guests we've ever had, Dick, and a very, very shrinking Wyler-type individual. Maybe we'll get him to say a few words if we're lucky.
But I may not say another word ever.
Arnold Stang, how are you tonight?
Normal.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Arnold, we've been looking forward to having you on this program for some time.
Why?
Well, because you're probably one of the funniest people I think ever to broadcast.
What do you mean, probably? I mean, can't you make up your mind one way or the other? I mean, let's make a judgment right now.
All right, the funniest.
What makes you say that? I can think of a half a dozen people that are much funnier.
Arnold, you know, were you born and brought up in New York? Are you one of those rare people?
No.
The reason I asked is because you started out in radio down in New York City on the Horn and Hardart show, remember?
Horn and Hardart Children's Hour.
All right.
I mean, let's give it its full title. Right. Otherwise, people might think it's some sort of an expletive. That's right. I started on the Children's Hour, and then 2 weeks later, I was on Let's Pretend. I used to do Let's Pretend on Saturday mornings and the Children's Hour on Sunday mornings. And then my voice changed, and I had to go into another line of work.
There was another show which was playing, I guess, on NBC. Let's Pretend was on CBS, Little Blue Playhouse. And
how did you know that?
Well, I did.
You
did
have
some
big
research.
Ears.
Yeah. But you weren't permitted to play on both, as I understand it, were you?
Well, it would be physically impossible since they were on pretty much the same time.
Yeah.
Certainly rehearsed same times. Mm-hmm. So that it wouldn't be possible to do both, nor anybody that could do Let's Pretend would certainly not want to do Little Blue Playhouse. Let's Pretend was the prestigious show to do.
That's right.
Won all the awards, and it was very highly coveted. And to this day, I don't know how I was lucky enough to be chosen by Nyla Mack that soon, because I had no track record, no mutual friends, you know, who could say, listen, he's very good. You know, and it was purely and simply just a lucky accident. I asked for the job, and she gave it to me, you know. I didn't know that it was that tough to do. I mean, I didn't know that people had, in some cases, waited 2 or 3 years just to get an audition
for
it. I went up to the office at a time when people knew you're not supposed to go there, but I didn't know that. I went up and met her, and I must say that for the first 3 years I was on the show, I was totally speechless every time she looked at me. For some reason, I was terrified of her. I cannot tell you why. She was one of the sweetest, most lovable people I ever knew. But there was a very very imperious look about her or something. She had a very round, feline kind of face and bulging eyes. But she was not severe in any way, except mm-hmm. that she looked severe, but she wasn't. She was very sweet and warm and a wonderful woman. She's been dead many years, so I can speak freely.
The Children's Hour was not an amateur hour in the sense
certainly not.
Major Bowes' amateur hour
anything,
was.
But no. it was the cream of the professional children were the ones who got on that show, and it won the equivalent of the Pulitzer Prize every year. It won the what were those prizes called? The
Peabody Awards.
Peabody Awards, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Every year it got the Peabody Award as the best children's show. There was nothing that could even come near it. It was considered the show. And Nyla Mack was certainly the spark plug of the show and responsible for all of the merit of the show, and yet her influence was so strong, and she had put the show together so well that for several years after she died, the show continued to be on and successful just on the basis of what she had done. Mostly we repeated things that that she had sort of done. You know, many times we did the same shows. Many of the shows were seasonal kind of shows. You did certain shows in certain seasons of the year. just as for certain holidays, there were Christmas shows or Easter shows or, you know. And she had an assistant named Richard Sandville, I think his name was. He always had a small D-E, which nobody remembered. And he continued to do the show after she went, plus somebody from BBD&O, who that was an advertising agency, Batten, Barton, Durstein, and Osborne. They had someone from, you know, the sponsor was Cream of Wheat, and so...
That's right. But I suppose
you
know, the...
darn right, it's right. When I said something that was wrong about a show I was actually...
You still eat
to.
Every day, don't you, Arnold, for breakfast?
No, at the same time...
What do you mean, no? Yes. Say yes. Think positive.
At the time you were doing the Let's Pretend show, were you also involved in other programs? I know we have a tremendous list of shows.
Well, I was... yes. You see, I came to New York because I didn't know that...
Where from?
From Chelsea, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. Actually, I took a bus from Boston. But I came to New York because I didn't know that it was almost impossible to break into radio, you know. So I had sent in a postcard asking if I could be on the show, and they sent back one of those letters, you know, very personal kind of letter, Dear Sir or Madam, as the case may be, you know, next time you're in New York, I was 9, but the next time you're in New York, if you come by, we will schedule an interview and an audition. So, of course, the following Saturday I went to New York and took an audition, and I was going to be a very serious dramatic actor, and they decided they found a new comedy personality. So they offered me a job, and I took it. And then I started, you know, to do other things. I went up and asked for a job on Let's Pretend, which I got. And then slowly other things came up, and I started doing things like Aunt Jenny's True Life Stories and whatever shows they needed kids on. And I was doing all of them, and I went on Broadway and played the lead in a Broadway play, out of which I got a picture contract and went to pictures and started doing movies and radio in California. And that's the story of my life.
It can't be quite that brief. And I think we'll get to those in a moment, but I'm anxious to hear Arnold Stang at work.
One day, when Chris Columbus was just a little lad, a young friend approached him and said,
Hey, Chris, what you doing?
I am thinking of what the world is like. And I have come to the conclusion that it is not flat, as we have been taught, but it is round.
And the other young lad, wise in the teachings of science, steeped in the lore of ancient doctrine, looked at Chris and replied,
Ah, you fire's ravioli.
But Chris Columbus, all Neapolitan boy, knew that he was right. And the next morning he said to his wise old father,
Oh, wise old father, I do indeed believe that the world is a sphere, surrounded on all sides by the heavens above us.
Drink your milk.
But, Father, have you observed how the horizon bends beyond the ocean, disappearing, as it were, in a circular orbit?
Drink your milk.
Look, Father, look at this egg. I can stand it on end. This proves beyond shadow of a doubt that gravity pulls in all directions, and the world is indeed round. What do you say to that, old father?
Eat your egg.
One day, young Christopher stood outside the great palace of the king and queen. As he looked up at the towering battlements, he had an idea. Taking a piece of chalk from his pocket, he wrote on the walls, Ferdinand loves Isabella. But before he could run away, a palace guard seized him and took him to the queen. She looked at the spunky lad and said,
Who are you? I am Christopher Columbus, all Palermo boy. Oh, Queen Isabella, I have a theory to which none will listen, but I know that thou, in thy great wisdom, will indeed pay heed. It is my firm belief, O Queen, that the world is round.
Oh, thy father's ravioli.
Oh, gracious Queen, I ask the wherewithal to sail around the world and prove my theory, O gracious Queen.
No.
Oh, gracious Queen, what do you say, gracious Queen? Just a couple of ships, will you? How will you, huh? Gracious Queen.
Oh, all right. Here's my diamond bracelet. Buy yourself a ship.
One ship ain't enough. I come across, gracious Queen. Will you, huh? Another ship, huh, Queen?
Oh, all right. Here's my emeralds. Get another ship.
No, I need 3, Queen, huh? Come on, bear's 4, Queen. What do you say? How about being a little gracious Queen?
Here's my necklace.
Gee, thanks, Queen. Thanks a lot, Queen. You're a prince.
Go already.
Okay, Queen. Thanks a lot, Queen. I'll see you around, Queen. Goodbye, Queen.
You're
Majesty.
Yes, Chancellor?
The man wants to sail around the earth. He's mad. You know the earth is flat.
Of course.
Then why did you give him your jewels?
I want him to sail to the edge and fall off.
We'll be back to the golden age of radio in a moment. The Cromwell Savings Bank now offers you ladies the opportunity to obtain colorful quality stoneware that will add life to your table settings, and it's available to you only through the Cromwell Savings Bank. But the best news is that you start your set free with a deposit of just $25. You get a four-piece play setting of durable stoneware safe to use from oven to table to dishwasher. Your first play setting is free. For each additional deposit of $25, you pay only $5.50 per play setting, a fraction of what similar quality would cost you retail. Come visit the Cromwell Savings Bank and see this stoneware. Add just $25 to your existing account or start a new account and walk out with your first four-piece play setting. Remember, it's free. Build a set of beautiful stoneware at the same time you build your savings. It costs only a few dollars. Sound unbelievable? It isn't. Come to Cromwell Savings Bank and see for yourself. The Cromwell Savings Bank is conveniently located on Main Street, Cromwell. Member FDIC.
Our guest tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio is Arnold Stang.
Again?
Again.
We came back for a second time.
Arnold, you know, my favorite character of all the characters you portrayed on radio was Gerard.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's true.
That's fascinating. Really. Well, Gerard was, I would say, one of my favorite characters, too, certainly by far. I thought, to me, anyway, he was the result of many other characters that I was. There was a little bit of, you know, like for most of my childhood, I played a character called Seymour Fingerhood on The Goldbergs.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, it was a character that Mrs. Berg had written years before for a boy she knew by the name of Garson Kanin, who went on to do other things, hadn't been heard of since.
That's right.
Married some very wealthy woman. But anyway, she pulled this character out of the files and had me play it, and I played that for years. And there was a little bit of Seymour Fingerhood, who was a kind of a shy kid from next door who was in love with Rosie on the Goldbergs. And there was a little of that. There was a little of the brash little boy that was Milton Berle's son, because I worked with Milton Berle on every radio show he did. You know, he was a flop in radio for years. He would try everything.
You
Bet Your Life or My Secret Ambition or he had a show for everybody, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a little bit of that. There was a little brashness. There was a little sophistication. There was a very naive quality. There was a sort of a shy quality to him, and yet there was a very cynical quality, too, you know, the what's to like kind of thing, you know.
The scripts, as I recall, were brilliant. And
they were, yes, yeah. They certainly were.
Did you or Henry contribute much to the scripts?
Some, but primarily, you know, by far the best writers available all wanted to work on that show, and mm-hmm. it had a tremendous influence on all branches of comedy, mm-hmm. but primarily the broadcasting. The people like Jack Benny would send his writers.
Really?
Yes. I mean, anybody. Fred Allen was a fan who used to come just and sit at rehearsals. And when it looked like the show was canceled, he offered to underwrite the sponsorship of it. And one whole year, he came on the show free and brought whatever guest stars, you know, that he was buying at something like $10,000, $15,000 a piece. He would bring them on for free on the show just to give the show a shot in the arm, you know, so that we could get all the top stars for nothing on the show. Plus, everybody wanted to work on the show.
Oh, I can imagine.
And we had practically every writer who has gone on to become very famous in pictures of Broadway at one time or another worked on that show. Everybody who worked on in New Yorker was contributing to the show.
Ed, do you remember the Little Theater of Coming Attractions?
Gee, I'm afraid not.
Well, that's where Gerard really started.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Gerard was just a sort of a device originally to get into the Coming Attractions Theater, where Gerard would call up Hortense. They got rid of Hortense. The original Hortense, you know, was Shirley Booth. And
no,
then after that,
know.
It was, a very tall woman, Betty Gard, who was the original Ann Eller in Oklahoma. And then they had Florence Halep playing it, and Ann Thomas played it briefly. But it was a device. And then eventually, Henry, who, like many geniuses, and I do really think he's a genius, and was even more of a genius then, he was a purer form of genius.
Yeah,
then.
Yeah.
Was also very emotional, and he got intensely jealous that this was a part of the show that he was not involved in, so it became Gerard and Henry rather than Hortense and Gerard. And, mm-hmm. you know, and then after that initial period of about a year and a half, There was no more Hortense, and the things that he would normally have done with Hortense, he was doing with Henry, except that it was expanded where it was two guys. And they went through the show. Gerard started to go through the show. And, of course, originally, when I started doing the Morgan show, there was no thought of doing anything like a Gerard character. I was really a utility man. That was one of the major kind of niches that I carved for myself in radio. Since you couldn't see what I'd look like, I played everything from 2,000-pound gorillas to, you know, little children.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I played romantic leads, villains, gangsters, frightened, anything you could think of. And when I went on, Henry, when he was getting ready to do his variety show, he asked Fred Allen, as a matter of fact, who I had worked for before, and a couple of other people. He wanted to get some utility people. And the one name, no matter who else they mentioned Jim Backus, and they mentioned Art Carney, and they mentioned Jack Lemmon was doing a lot of stuff like that, and people like that. They would always mention my name, too, because I seemed to be able to do many dialects and different voices and change my voice and stuff. So he called me, and I had known him socially, but he never even thought of me as you know. And so I started doing dialect things and crazy screaming voices and little whispering kind of things and stuff. And then slowly this Gerard character was just another thing out of six or seven other things I was doing on the show.
Mm-hmm.
But it caught the fancy of the public. And it grew. And then suddenly people like Neil Simon and Joe Stein, who wrote Fiddler on a Roof and Plain and Fancy and Zorba and all those other, and a lot of movies, were writing for Gerard. And practically every well-known television picture writer at one time or another would write Gerard routines and give them to Henry, and then we would end up using them.
I recall one sequence, I believe you were investigating a murder case, and the victim was the... The murdered victim died of chapped lips, I think. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, well, we would do those kind of things very often. After a while, it got almost impossible to find something we hadn't done.
Yeah, I know.
And I found that very often the things we were satirizing on that show, I was doing straight somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Literally. I mean, I would go in and do something like the Philip Morris Playhouse, you know, Tallulah Bankhead was doing the leads then. I would play a very serious, dramatic kind of part, and then a day or two later, I'd be on the Morgan show doing a satirical version of the same thing by accident. I found that over the years, the lines were constantly being crossed, and it's amazing I didn't just become completely schizophrenic, because I could never really make up my mind all those years to the fact that I was going to do better in comedy than I was going to do as a serious actor, because I was so serious about comedy, I guess, anyway. But I was doing a tremendous amount of serious work, and most of the awards that I won in broadcasting, anyway, were for serious acting, not for comedy. I never won an award in radio for a comedy performance, and I won a lot of awards, all kinds of awards, for serious roles. And the only time I've ever gotten an Academy Award nomination was for a serious dramatic role in pictures. It was not for a comedy role, and I've certainly done 100 times more comedy things than pictures. The only time I've ever written for pictures, I've written comedy. The only time I've ever directed in pictures was comedy. The only time I've starred in pictures was in comedy.
I think that would attest to your ability, Arnold. Let's listen to an excerpt.
I think that's a criticism. I think that's very interesting. I'm bleeding from every pore. That's a pretty snide remark if I ever made
one. You're supposed to be the host, and
boy,
you like that. I don't get that. You know, it never happened before.
Let's listen to an excerpt from the Henry Morgan Show with Gerard.
Morgan Show. Yes, the Henry Morgan Show, sponsored by Bristol Myers, makers of Vitalis for well-groomed hair, and Mum the Safer Deodorant, with Arnold Stang, Kenny Delmar, Betty Harris, and Jeff Clark, music of Milton Kadem, and me, Ben Grauer. And here's the star of the Henry Morgan Show, standing on his favorite corner in front of the cigar store.
Good evening, anybody. Here's Morgan. That's very sweet of you. Thank you. Say, did you see the new fall dresses? Did you see the new necklines? Very low. Below the shoulders. Those dresses are very expensive. Yet, they're all without visible means of support. I saw one gown... Thank you, Bob Hope. I saw one gown that went beyond anything I'd ever seen before. This dress guarantees to get a girl a husband or double her boyfriend's back. And that was very amusing at one time. And these skirts are tight, very tight. So tight that women will have to Vaseline their heads to slip them on. That's funny. I thought the other one was funnier. They had a display of the new girdles at the show, too. Of course, the designs were new, but the same old rule applies for girdles. Remember, you only get out of a girdle what you put into it. Well, that joke was leased to me by this Fred Allen for the summer. They also showed the new French-type bathing suits. A girl came out wearing one of these French suits. Never has so little covered so little since that girl was very little. I understand. No, don't applaud it. My goodness, we have at least three more jokes before the program's over. I understand they're beginning to sell these French bathing suits in New York. They come to you wrapped in a summons. When the girl gets home, she unties the package, keeps the summons, and puts on the string. You know, the girl... the girl who wears, thank you, orchestra. Almost as loud as Ray Block's orchestra. The girl who... Louder. The girl who wears one... I'm still on the French bathing suit thing. The girl who wears one can have her boyfriend sing her a lullaby. Baby, you're so cold outside. It's true. So much of her is outside. Well, possibly I'll do some more research on that and throw the whole routine. Oh, excuse me. Here comes my friend Gerard. Hello, Gerard.
Hiya.
You look a little sunburned, Gerard. Were you away?
Yeah, I went to some resort for the weekend.
Oh, that's nice. Did you like it?
Ugh.
What was the name of the place?
Villa O'Houlihan.
Villa O'Houlihan.
Yeah, on the Hudson.
Hey, tell me something. How'd you happen to go there?
Well, I seen an ad in the papers. It said, relax in a rustic retreat set in natural picturesque surroundings.
And?
It was a veterans housing project that was condemned.
Yeah. Well, why was it condemned?
Alligators.
Isn't that ridiculous? Alligators on the Hudson. At worst, they were probably lizards.
Heck, I seen them. They were alligators.
Well, maybe they were big lizards.
All right.
All right.
So I should spend $15 a day to relax with big lizards.
No, seriously. I'm sure if they had a resort there, there was more to do than just look at lizards.
Yeah. The ad said indoor and outdoor sports.
Well?
They had a checkerboard in a lounge.
That was the indoor sport?
That was both.
What do you mean?
On a nice day, they moved the checkerboard outside.
Well, but what about exercise? They must have had some kind of exercise.
Yeah, they had exercise.
Well, what?
Carrying the checkerboard.
Well, it wasn't a place for athletes. Sounds more like a rest home.
How could you rest? Those birds outside your window every morning.
Birds outside the window can be very pleasant.
Buzzards?
Buzzards? No.
I tell him yes, he tells me no.
Gerard, it's impossible. They were not buzzards.
All right, lizards.
Still sounds like a rest home, Gerard. Tell me, how was the food?
The ad said good American cooking.
And?
Maybe it was cooked by a good American, but the food was terrible.
Sounds like a pretty depressing place. Was there anything to do evenings?
The ad said dancing every night.
Dancing? Well, you must have enjoyed that.
Even the first couple of nights, it was boring.
Why?
Who wants to dance with Mr. O'Houlihan?
Well, in that case, of course, I don't blame you.
Sure. All the time, he wants to lead.
Was there anybody else there?
Only O'Houlihan's father. He couldn't dance at all.
Well, if I don't get to the studio pretty soon. Oh, here comes old Gideon Pillsbury Jr. Nice old Pop. Hiya, Pop.
Well, hello, Sonny. You can't stop and talk now. I'm going in the cigar store and get me a box of cigars. I'm a father.
A father? Well, no kid. Congratulations. When did it happen?
61 years ago.
Well, why are you getting the cigars now?
Why? Because the store will be closed later.
Yeah, but
how old do you think I am?
Oh, 82?
93. No, I'm 93 because I never put oil on my body. Oil closes up the pores. Pores have to breathe. Do you ever lie still and feel the hair on your arms uncurl?
I think so.
That's your pores breathing through the hair.
Jeez.
How old do you think I am?
93.
82.
Didn't you say
it? Was the fireman who invented the first frozen popsicle.
A fireman invented the popsicle?
During the big fire up at Hockomock Head in the winter of 1878. It was so cold, the water froze up solid in the watering hose.
I see.
This here fireman had one finger stuck in the nozzle. He unscrewed his finger and there it was, the first popsicle.
Finger flavored.
When the fireman died, the popsicle makers put up a monument to him.
What was it?
70-foot finger wrapped in wax paper.
No kidding.
And next to it is a statue of a small boy perspiring. You know what it says underneath?
What?
Keep off the grass. I had a friend named Bing Coolidge.
Bing Coolidge.
No relation to the singer.
I see.
Yeah, the Bing worked in the gravel pit, and his paws got all clogged up with gravel powder.
And?
Yeah, when his paws tried to breathe, they made a hissing sound. Every one of his paws was like a tiny pee whistle.
No kidding.
Yeah, he had paws that snored. Old fella, too, yeah? How old do you think Bing was?
Oh, 85.
No, not me, Bing.
Oh, are you 85?
91. Well, I can't stand no more of your blabbing, sonny. I'll never make it this way.
Make what?
92. So long, son. Keep your eye on Dr. Townsend.
So long, Bob. Hey, taxi!
The Golden Age of Radio continues in a moment. There's a beautiful free gift waiting for you at Cromwell Savings Bank, and a wonderful new way to build a steadily growing savings account. The free gift is a four-piece place setting of stoneware, yours for opening or adding to a savings account for $25 or more. Then, while steadily building your savings account with deposits of $25 or more, you can own this dinnerware, which may be used from oven to table to dishwasher. Come in soon to Cromwell Savings Bank to inspect this durable stoneware. We'll show you how you can acquire a complete dinner service for a fraction of the retail value while your bank account grows. The best way to start building your bank account is to act now with your free four-piece place setting from Cromwell Savings Bank. You'll soon have the set you want while your bank account increases your reserve for security. Visit the Cromwell Savings Bank, Main Street, Cromwell, soon. Member FDIC.
Our guest tonight, Arnold Stang, here on the Golden Age of Radio. Of course, in those early days, Henry Morgan had pretty well been established, but I'm wondering, on a national basis, was he known? He was always local, known for Old Man Adler's commercials in New York and so on. But
are we taping now?
Yeah, we're recording.
Oh, that's because I thought you were playing the record, that old transcription.
You missed that one too, huh?
I didn't know. I didn't miss it. I wasn't interested, so how could I miss it?
No, but was he known?
I think he was very well known. Yes, he was very well known, and he was intensely disliked, and I will never understand that. Actually, I do understand it, but I mean, I don't think he deserved it. I really don't think he deserved it at all. But because he had this very, what some people thought was very arrogant and sort of a malevolent attitude about things, but this was part of his satire. People anticipated his being nasty when he had no intention of being nasty. He was a very sweet man and still is. He has very strong defense kind of mechanism, so to speak, because of the fact that he feels that he's been misunderstood so many times. But very often people would take offense to the most inoffensive, simple kind of thing that he would say or do. The first time that he went to Hollywood, after he had his own show, we went out there to do a movie together. It was the first film that Stanley Kramer ever produced, and it was the first film that Dick Fleischer ever directed, and it was a comedy written by Ring Lardner called So This Is New York. It was based on a Ring Lardner story called The Big Town.
Yeah, it was
the Big Town.
Turn of the century, wasn't it, the setting for that?
The setting, I don't know. I don't remember what the period was. But it was sort of period.
Mm-hmm.
And We went out there, and we went out, I think, either the first or second night we were there, we went out to dinner, and practically everybody in the restaurant we went to took offense at something he said, and in no case, without exception, in no case did he say anything that they would have taken exception to from anyone else in the world. I'm sure that I must have been 1,000 times nastier than he was to people, and people smiled and thought it was terribly amusing and never took offense at it, because the character that I was identified with was an inoffensive character.
Mm-hmm.
The character he was identified with had this kind of sardonic quality, and therefore they told him off before they had a, you know, before he did anything that deserved being told off for. And this happened all over the country. We went out and, after the picture was finished, and we did personal appearances, and he finally stopped doing them, because what happened was that wherever we went, he had these experiences.
That's unfortunate.
He's a brilliant man.
Yeah. I'm sure he is. I've never had the opportunity to meet him, and I hope someday that we have him on the show.
Well, on television, I'd say you don't see that role anymore. He's kind
of torn down. No, but now, you see, it turns my stomach a little, because it's so phony, but he chuckles and he tries to be
he's not creative
kindly, and it's kind of like he's bleeding from every pore while he's doing it, because, and it's so false, it's certainly not very convincing. But he, and the thing that's heartbreaking is he feels that he must do that. Because having the intelligence and having the taste and the judgment and the knowledge and the experience is not enough. He feels that it's not enough. He feels that he has to be lovable, and he feels that he has to be, you know, just plain Bill or something. But he'll never be just plain Bill, and he'll never be what he's trying to pretend to be now. And the only reason that he's doing these panel shows that he does do was because of what he's done in the past, not because of... because he chuckles, or because he's just plain Bill. He never will be anyway, so why doesn't he? But he can't, so.
Speaking of just plain Bill, did
who's
you ever do any soap
just plain Bill?
Ever do any soap operas?
Why don't you pay attention? Attention must be paid. A man is not an orange, you know. You can't just throw away the peel. I mentioned Aunt Jenny's True Life Stories.
You
I mentioned
did.
The Goldbergs. I mentioned
That's
Easy
right.
Aces. How many do I have to tell you before we get to them?
Yeah, he's been on soaps, Dick.
I've been on lots of soaps.
That's right.
Oh.
And you play the mostly serious parts. You never was any real comedy soaps at all.
No,
not
in soaps.
Oh,
attention.
No, no such thing. No, the only comedy comes out of the
no, comedy soaps I'm referring to.
Yeah, oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, has this Gerard, has he taken over as far as your image, you think, today in the comedy role?
No.
No?
Oh, I don't think so. You mean personally?
People expect you to hear Gerard when they meet Arnold Stanley.
Do they? No. I some people might. I think some people expect to hear Francis, the nasty stagehand. I don't know what people expect to hear. I know that Until the Fire, I had a collection of scripts, screenplays, Broadway plays, television scripts, radio scripts, and presentations for future shows and things of that nature that ran one whole shelf, which was 24 feet long, in my den. And no two were duplicates. And each one of them had in it a character they called an Arnold Stang character or an Arnold Stang type, and no two were alike. So I have no idea what any two people think is the Arnold Stang character. I'm doing a character in a play right now that is a man in his 40s who's split up with his wife and has certain personal problems and certain emotional problems and other things like that. Just before I did this, I did a 23-year-old Greenwich Village type who was very shy with girls and was always striking out on dates like that. Just before that, I played a 63-year-old Georgia redneck who had pellagra and was lecherous of his own teenage daughter and finally sells her for a bag of turnips in a play called Tobacco Road.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, I was playing a college student in Charlie's Aunt. And I've done many different characters in many different plays. I also did a very hammy actor in a play in Denver before that. And we can go on and on and on. I mean,
you know what I'm curious to know? When Larry Haynes was on our program several months back, he said that Phillips H. Lord would cast visually.
Seth Lord.
Yeah. Now, did you have to give him the impression of a gangster, or how did you get parts
for
gangbusters?
I played kind of newsboys and elevator operators, and I played a half-wit killer once for him, and things of that nature I did for him. Yes, he did. I always had to play people who were small physically with glasses, probably. That's right.
You didn't step out of character then on that particular show then.
Oh, sure. It didn't matter. I mean, no two personalities could be alike, long as physically they were small. Don't you see? I mean, it really was. He didn't know what I was like.
Well, that was the beauty of radio. You did play you said you played a 2,000-pound gorilla in
sure.
one show, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I played everything. I played Spit and Dead End quite a few times, as a matter of fact. And I played romantic leads, and I played killers, and whatever you can name. I mean, the whole spectrum. It didn't matter, as long as you could do a convincing voice. And sometimes you play two or three different characters.
Speaking of characters, inasmuch as our whole show is devoted to comedy tonight, I'd like to ask Ed if he'll play one of my very favorite comedic situations. And let's see, Arnold Stang, if you agree with this. Let's hear a bit of The Life of Riley.
The Life of Riley with William Bendix as Riley. Whenever Chester A. Riley entertains you at dinner, he dishes out large portions of everything, especially advice. Tonight, the Rileys have as their guest a young man who works at the aircraft plant with Riley.
Oh, that sure was a swell dinner, Mrs. Riley.
Well, thank you, Tommy. Glad you enjoyed it.
Peg, you take Tommy inside and I'll go dish up the coffee. We don't drink our coffee at the table, Tommy. We always have it after dinner in the library.
Library?
Yeah, that's our library over there. Them two Esquires on top of the radio.
Riley.
Gee, you sure got a swell house here. You know, my wife would give anything for a home like this.
Oh, she'll have one, Tommy. Just be patient. You're young yet.
Peg's right. Owning your home is a big responsibility.
And it's a lot of work.
Certainly is. Washing windows, mowing the lawn, fixing screens, unblocking the sink. It ties a man down. Sometimes when we have a date, I have to hang around for hours waiting for Peg to get through.
Yeah, I know. I know there's a lot of work, but it's a lot better than living with your in-laws.
Oh, I didn't know you lived with your in-laws.
Ever since we got married. It isn't easy.
Oh, I don't know. You could be worse off than living with your in-laws. You could be living with, you could be living down in, you could be dead.
Any attention to him, Tommy. Why, when Riley and I first got married, we lived with my folks.
Sure, and we got along fine with them. They loved me insanely. Her father was even more insane to me than her mother.
Yeah, but gee, my wife's father, well, he keeps reminding me that I'm dependent on him, like he's giving me charity.
Oh, you mustn't feel that way.
Oh, you're going at this all wrong, Tommy. You see, I knew how to talk to Peg's old man. Now, just a minute, I said. So what if you're giving me free room and board? I'm entitled to a break. After all, I took your daughter off your hands.
Oh. Why, you never said any such thing.
Well, maybe not those words exactly, but I put him in his place, and that's what you got to do, Tommy.
Yeah, I guess so.
I'll go get us some hot coffee. It's freezing in here since I fixed that heating system. Excuse me.
Gee, I wish I was like Mr. Riley. You know, not afraid of anybody.
Tommy, would you like to hear how Riley really handled his in-law problem?
Well, he just said
that. Yes, I heard what he said, but he left out a few details.
Well, sure. I'd like to hear all about it.
Well, when we first got married, we had to live with my folks. Riley didn't have a job. I kept on with my job, of course, but I didn't make enough to pay rent on a place of our own. Living with my folks wasn't very pleasant. I remember one day.
That's me, Dumpling.
Hello, dear. Any luck?
No, I walked my feet off. Oh, it's no use, Peggy. I guess I might as well face it. I'm a failure.
Oh, you are not. You'll connect one of these days, you see.
Oh, Peggy, my wonderful darling wife. Here I am broke. I haven't worked a day since we're married, and you're so sweet to me. Oh, if we could only go on like this forever.
Mom and sister are out visiting, but Pop will be home any minute. Then we'll have supper.
Wait a minute. I got something for you, Peggy. Here, Angel.
Roses! Oh, Chester, they're beautiful. Chester, you spent your lunch money on me again.
No, I didn't pay for them. You know in the park where they got a design of Mayor Noonan's face made with roses?
Yes.
Well, from now on, the mayor's name is No Nose Noonan.
Oh, you shouldn't.
Don't be mad.
Oh, I forgive you. Here, Chester, for the roses.
Tomorrow the mayor's going to be bald-headed.
Well, sit down now, dear, and here's the evening paper.
Oh, thanks. Oh, this is living, Dumplin'.
Oh, good evening, Papa.
Good evening, my dear.
Good evening, Papa.
Huh.
Supper's almost ready, Papa. Why don't you sit down?
How can I when somebody who doesn't pay a cent toward the rent is sitting in my chair?
Oh, Papa, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Here's your chair, Papa.
And don't call me Papa.
Yes, sir, Mr. Barker.
Well, supper's practically ready, Papa. Here, you read your paper.
How can I when somebody who isn't paying a cent toward the rent has already got it?
Oh, Papa, why are you always picking on Chester? He's trying to get a job. He just has no luck.
No luck. He's just lazy.
Chester is not lazy.
No, he isn't, huh? I met Mr. Pryor today. Told me that he offered that husband of yours a job in his theater as an usher. And he turned it down.
Oh, Chester, why didn't you take it?
I already seen the picture. I mean, well, anyway, it was only temporary until the regular usher got back from lunch.
Oh, alibis, always alibis. For somebody who doesn't pay a cent...
Papa, if you say that once more,
Now, look what you've done, you chiseler. Why did I ever let my daughter marry a nincompoop like you?
Now you're going a little too far. You can call me a chiseler, you can call me a loafer, but you got no right calling me an nincompoop. When you know yourself I ain't got no income. Don't cry, Dumplin'. Don't be mad at me.
Oh, it's not you, Chester. I just can't bear it, living with my folks this way.
Well, it ain't so bad, Peggy. I'm getting used to sleeping on the living room couch. And you've got a bed all to yourself in your sister's room. But don't you like sleeping with your sister?
Oh, Chester, we just got to get a place of our own.
I know, Dumplin'. We've been saying that all along.
Well, yes, but now there's a special reason. You see, well, we'll need more room. There's someone coming to sort of visit us.
Oh, that's nice. When?
In about 6 months.
Anyone I know?
Well, not exactly.
Well, that's okay. Your friends are my friends. But can't he postpone his visit for a year or two?
Oh, Chester, you don't understand. I got some news for you. It's a surprise.
Peg, you don't mean...
I'm going to have a baby.
Oh. Oh, a baby. Oh. For a minute there, I thought you lost your job. But if all you're worrying about is a baby, a baby. A baby. Peg, I'm going to have a baby. Don't move, Peg. I'll carry you to the hospital.
Oh, put me down, Chester. It won't be for quite a while.
Oh, Peg, darling, it's wonderful. A baby. And it won't be like the wedding ring I gave you. We'll own the baby outright. Gosh, a baby. What kind will it be?
Well, I don't know yet, silly.
Gee, I hope it's a boy or a girl. Oh, I'm so excited.
Well, I'm glad you're glad, Chester. But now you see why we just have to get a place of our own.
Yeah, we'll move out of here first thing tomorrow. I'll get a job. This baby's going to change our luck. I'll get a job. You'll see.
Oh, I know you will. And it doesn't have to pay very much because I'll go on working.
No, you won't.
But I can work.
No, nothing doing, sweetheart. No, from now on, you're staying home. I want you to be right there with the baby when it's born.
We'll be back to the Golden Age of Radio in 1 minute. Ladies, how does your dinnerware look? Chipped? Pieces missing? Pattern worn away? Well, now is the time to replace your worn-out set with colorful stoneware available only through the Cromwell Savings Bank. But the best news is that you start your set free with a deposit of just $25. you get a four-piece play setting of durable stoneware, safe to use from oven to dishwasher. Your first play setting is free. For each additional deposit of $25, you pay only $5.50 per play setting, a fraction of what similar quality would cost you retail. Come on down to the Cromwell Savings Bank and see this stoneware. Add just $25 to your existing account or start a new account and walk out with your first four-piece play setting. Remember, it's free. Build a set of beautiful stoneware at the same time you build your savings. It costs only a few dollars. Sound unbelievable? It isn't. Come to Cromwell Savings Bank and see for yourself. The Cromwell Savings Bank is conveniently located on Main Street, Cromwell. Member FDIC.
Arnold, you were sharing a story with us earlier that involves your children at Greenfield Village. You had just returned from a visit, I believe, to Canada, and this kind of puts things into perspective as to what Daddy was doing.
Remember? Well, it was just that we were talking about how you had a list of about three or four radio shows, and you said, as far as I know, you were on some radio shows, and you mentioned something, and I said, oh, I go way back. You name a show, there was any show. It could be Martin and Lewis or Henry Morgan or Ralph Morgan or Johnny Morgan or Frank Morgan. I worked with all the Morgans and J.P. Morgan and Roberta Quinlan and the Mohawk, whatever that. I said, to give you an idea, my children were up visiting in Canada, and I was doing a play in Detroit. The funny thing happened on the way to the Forum was the play. We were at the Fisher Theater, and so I had them come down from Canada, and we went to the Ford Museum, which is next to Greenfield Village. They have a whole hall of communication where they have many old shows, and through the fact that they knew I was coming with the children, on the loudspeaker system, they were playing Al Jolson's Shell Chateau with a special guest star, Arnold Stang. So, of course, suddenly, to the kids, I was ancient, you know, and they asked me whether they had cars when I was a little boy and sure. Were there dinosaurs still around, Daddy. When you were a boy, did they still have dinosaurs?
One name you haven't mentioned is Joe Penner.
Yeah, I did. I worked with Joe Penner. I mean, you know, I was just a kid in a couple of the sketches. But it's true. I worked with everybody. I mean, there are people who you never think of as doing variety shows. I mean, I did comedy sketches with people like Walter Winchell or... I don't know. You name it.
You know, the thing that surprises me, Arnold, is that you said you were 9 years old when you arrived on the doorstep of
when
Warren
I became
Hartis,
a star.
Children's Hour, right. Did
and
you
I was
this on
steadily downhill from then on. By the time I was 10, I was a has-been, washed up.
Were you being pushed by family?
No,
or
my family didn't fully approve of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, they didn't know, and they very reluctantly gave me permission to stay in New York. My family wasn't even in New York. I had an aunt that lived in New York who I stayed with till my family moved down. But originally, when I came to New York, my family was still all up in Massachusetts. And the only thing was that I had to keep my grades up in school. As long as I kept my grades up in school, I would be allowed to do this. But it was kind of like an indulgence on their part. They couldn't care less. And then nobody in my family has ever had anything to do with show business before or since.
So when
so
did the
I don't think
bite
I've proven
you?
Anything.
Do you recall at all?
I guess it was a prenatal influence, something like that. On the way, I thought, gee, you know, if I ever do get born, I want to be in radio. I mean, kids run away to join a circus. I ran away to get into radio. I mean, you can see what a strange kid I must have been, you know, crawling under the TV antenna or something.
Did any of these kids' shows influence you, like Jack Armstrong or Buck Rogers? Did you
no.
kind of turn you on at that time?
No. I used to do... which one did I do? I was a regular on the one that Alan Duchovny did.
Chicago?
Oh, or? Superman. I used to be on Superman. And then later I was on Captain Video in television, which was also a kid show. I was on that for a long time, on Captain Video. My wife always laughs because I say we had wooden television cameras. But actually, you know, the frames, the dollies that the cameras rolled on were wooden. And we did it from Wanamaker's, which was a department store down in Greenwich Village.
I know that Watermaker studio so
it's
well.
It's not there anymore.
I know it, but I used to
burned
sit
down.
Up. I used to sit up in the balcony.
It's now
and
a gigantic
watch the
apartment house, you know.
It really is. Oh, it's.
Would I kid you?
No, Arnold, you wouldn't.
I certainly would not. But that's where we did it.
Sure. Oh, I remember that studio well and that show.
Jeez, before my time.
What about...
yes, what about...
one show called That Brewster Boy in which
yeah,
you starred.
Yeah, I played Joey Brewster.
Yeah.
That was off at Quaker Oats. It was on Friday nights, and it was very similar to Henry Aldridge, except that it passed Henry Aldridge and became, I guess, the number one radio show during that period. And Henry Aldridge kind of went into decline and then later came back in television. as a series. And I play Joey Brewster. I was not the original. I think the original was Dick York, who's in pictures. He played Elizabeth Montgomery's husband.
Yeah, and, he was also Billy Fairfield and Jack Armstrong, too.
Yeah. He also worked on Vic and Sade periodically, which was what I envied more than, because I thought Vic and Sade was one of the greatest radio shows ever done. And to give you an idea, for two or three years anyway, I used to kid around with Henry, who also loved Vic and Sade, about how if he really wanted to please me, he'd get Uncle Fletcher. And do you know he brought Clarence Hartzell to New York and we had him on the show? He was the biggest flop that ever happened on the show. The most boring conversationalist. This man used to come in and talk for 5 or 6 hours about an auto accident he had. Always the same auto accident. And that's all he would talk about. He had no conversation. He'd come on the show and it was the genius of Paul, what was the guy?
Paul Reimer,
right. Who made him so great, because on our show, he was a bust. As a matter of fact, what happened was, we had gotten a little head on scripts, and we brought in Doro Mirandi, who I think is marvelous. Anyway, you know, she's a character woman, brilliant. She played my girlfriend in A Man with a Golden Arm, as a matter of fact. She used the old Clarence Hartzell scripts that weren't used, and she was very good. Then later, she was in Front Page with me last year.
Arnold,
that is a
course,
lot later, isn't it?
That's yeah. That's being revised on that Front Page. It was right out in,
what do you mean revised?
It was in Hollywood.
Rewritten.
Well, it's being
revived,
done. It's being
mean,
done as
revived.
A movie. Yeah.
It's just closed last Sunday, I know.
Yeah, he's taking lessons, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
But not from
an apprentice.
Yeah, well, after the things you said to me earlier, I'm surprised I'm even still talking to you.
Yeah, but you're
whatever
my buddy.
Your name is. But don't get me wrong,
name.
I'm crazy about you. Yeah.
Arnold, we've run out of time, but thanks
so much. I haven't. I got a lot more I want to talk about.
Thanks so much for visiting with us here on the Golden Age of Radio.
Bye.
And until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you by WTIC and Cromwell Savings Bank, an equal housing lender, located at Main and West Streets in Cromwell. Join Dick Bertel and Ed Corcoran again on Wednesday, July 24th, when our guest will be the noted radio and motion picture actor Robert Cummings. Technical supervision by Bob Schirago. The Golden Age of Radio is produced by Bill Grasty and Dick Bertel.
Pepper Young's Family. The story of your friends, the Youngs, is brought to you by Camay, the mild beauty soap for a smoother, softer complexion.
Rinse-o white and rinse-o bright.
Broadcasting from New York City, the